Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. On today's podcast, we welcome back sector strategist Denise Chisholm for another installment of her Sector Watch. Denise shares with host Pamela Ritchie that the United States is currently leading with the amount of stimulus delivered, and based on that fact, will likely lead in terms of economic growth delivered. Denise also explains that she sees U.S. small caps being dominant in market leadership, based on relative valuation and growth data. Energy and financials are continued to be viewed favorably by Denise. Also, Denise believes the risk-reward for gold and silver is still positive. Today's podcast was recorded on April 1st, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Welcome, Denise. Great to see you.
Thanks so much, Pamela. It's great to be here again.
Very glad to have you joining us here today. I have to just start with the equity market and take a look at this sort of eye-popping number of 4,000. Mm-hmm. Risk on right before an employment report. Is that surprising to you?
In some ways, not a lot. I mean, when you look at historical parallels, the move we've seen, ironically, where investors think it's too far, too fast, or there should be more sort of risk off back and forth, what you see is a market that's been up like this and by like this, I mean, up 50% on a month-end basis on a year. When you look that next year, it actually is a point at which you see higher than 50-50 odds that the market continues to go up. So from that perspective, a ball in motion tends to stay in motion if you're the equity market. So it's not too historically problematic when I look at the risk on nature and the sort of eye-popping, as you said, 4,000 level on the S&P 500.
Stimulus was announced, as we talked about this week, or at least, you know, the debate has begun for the next piece of stimulus and how that'll work for infrastructure and so on. But stimulus is a huge part of the story that we are all sitting in right now. Can you sort of help us begin to break it down for the employment picture?
Yeah, I think that you need to think about stimulus as the defining part of this cycle that makes it different from last cycle and to some extent than any cycle. Because it was really the first recession since 1957 that we had coincident stimulus enacted during the recession. So, and obviously 2 to 3x what we've normally seen.
Sorry, what does that mean, coincident stimulus? What does that mean?
As the recession hit, benefits were expanded. When you think about the great financial crisis, really you were 75% of the way through the recession before you actually got checks from the federal government and infrastructure spending announced that was then back-end loaded. And if you look, I mean, the interesting thing about the equity markets, if you look at the months after the recession hit and the stimulus that was enacted, you'll see that it's very correlated to how quickly the equity markets discount a recession, meaning that the earlier stimulus is, the less of a way through the recession that the equity market tends to bottom. Now, look, this time it was about a month, which seemed historically rare. But when you look through the data, it actually makes sense, given that stimulus is so important. And I think the second factor of stimulus in terms of the discounting mechanism is what will it lead to this cycle versus last cycle? And here thematically, I mean, most people concentrate on inflation, which is correct to concentrate on because I think it is predictive in the income growth buckets we've seen. But I think what's going to be defining this cycle relative to last cycle is the lessening probability of deflation. And that's what's going to be very different over the next decade that was not the case at all in, let's call it, the 60s, 70s, which I think some people are gravitating towards to think about an inflationary playbook like that. This is very different. Inflation expectations right after the 2009 crisis or the great financial crisis really went back to a deflationary trend. So despite the fact that CPI was pretty sticky between, let's call it 1.5 and 2.5, you wouldn't say that's deflationary. Inflation expectations were declining that entire time, saying if there is a shock, we could easily tip over into deflation, which is just as corrosive to the equity market as inflation was in the late 70s and early 80s.
And you just remember the terms that were used of, you know, and the deflationary sort of concern was part of this, the unloved, the biggest unloved bull market, you know, I mean, all those terms right. that were put into that. And as you say, because it wasn't that long ago, it's still very much in everyone's memory, but it really isn't the same.
Right. Certainly from investors. I mean, we always sort of as investors gravitate to what we just went through. And I think what I'm trying to get across as best I can is just how different this cycle is versus the last cycle. So any sort of playbook or analog, I think you need to think critically of before you invest on.
When you hear the discussion about, for instance, demographics, you know, we just spoke to a couple people this week who said, you know, demographics are still in place. We still have an aging population. We still have the same situation. And we still have so-called robots and automation, basically,
yes.
coming to take jobs.
Yes.
How do we square those?
Yes, you will still have secular disinflationary or deflationary pressures. That's not going away. And in some ways, that's why you can balance it against a potential wall of stimulus that will increase inflationary pressures. And I don't mean to sound sort of naive when I say the puts and takes might actually end up in a sweet spot for the equity market, because statistically, that Goldilocks outcome that I'm sort of talking about is actually the highest odds, right? In some ways, it is usually that you have a bunch of headwinds and a bunch of tailwinds that honestly net out to some extent. And I think that that's what we're seeing. There's going to be tax. There's a lot of stimulus that's going to create an inflationary impetus, but there's also a lot of headwinds, both in taxes and in the secular demographics and secular productivity deflationary trends that we're seeing. And I think that balance, to my eye, based on what I see in the data, might mean more of the lack of deflation than it is to aggressive inflation.
So stimulus comes along, but this is a U.S. story. I mean, you know, Canada has issued unbelievable amounts of stimulus and people debate
right.
whether it's too much and too little. But does it become a more U.S. dominant story when you know, relative to the rest of the world? Because it's been more stimulus.
Right. I think so. So it is a global phenomenon. We certainly, the U.S. leads the pack in terms of stimulus delivered. And I think based on that fact, it will likely lead in terms of growth delivered. Which means that historically, the U.S. is market leadership. From a sort of up and down the cap spectrum, I'd still pick U.S. small caps as dominant global market leadership. So as much as people talk about potential recovery plays in emerging markets or international, the way I'm seeing the relative valuation and relative growth data puts the U.S. squarely in sort of the positive risk-reward bucket. So as much as people, this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, when we talked about last cycle, China exporting inflation, I think it might be switched to the U.S. potentially exporting inflation. Not in nearly the same way, but I think conceptually you can think about it like that.
That's very interesting because there's a lot of discussion of sort of leakage of stimulus too, and you know
yes.
how that worked to perhaps create inflation in China, but other places too,
right.
as it kind of leaked across borders, or that seems to be the term. That's used anyway. Let's go into some of the sectors themselves. So within value, obviously there are a number of places to look. Tell us your favorite.
Yeah. So I think we talked about last time. I mean, two dominant places when I think anybody thinks value are energy and financials. Energy is by far my favorite just because the data setup is so unique. I always say that, you know, there's two times in an energy investor's life that you really need to pay attention to sort of overweighting the group. One is when it's cheap on all levels. It never was in 2014, 15, 16, and it still isn't. But the second time is when you see demand declines. And the problem with you seeing demand declines is that you think, oh, it might be the bottom in fundamentals. It's not. The fundamentals tend to lag even after equity stock market troughs for a year or two but you get the outperformance on multiple expansion. So in the energy sector has done something very unique this cycle, which is the defining part of the last decade was they had to spend so much money to get oil out of the ground. The CapEx relative to sales was at top quartile levels and free cash flow was at bottom quartile levels. So even though crude oil was fundamentally a stair-step pattern higher than it was in the past, their returns were no different and in some ways impaired by that. They're finally out of those top quartile levels, which means the potential sales growth acceleration is likely to be rewarded by investors. So you have energy being a recovery play where the damage that impaired them last cycle might have been sort of fixed from a capital expenditure perspective. But I think that the second close corollary to energy is financials. And investors need to think about it as a very, very unique sector. And it's actually been green on my quarterly sector update scorecard, which you can find at fidelity.qsu.com or fidelity.com/QSU. Excuse me. I should know that better off the top of my head.
Is it also on your LinkedIn?
On my LinkedIn. The financials charts that we're going to talk about are on my LinkedIn. And it is a really unique sector in some ways post the great financial crisis. First, anything that you thought worked, improving ROEs, relative earnings growth, all of a sudden after the great financial crisis didn't give you those strong odds, partly because multiples were compressing as interest rates were at secularly low levels. So in some ways, the exact story we're talking about with secularly higher inflationary and interest rate levels that might be a good thing given lack of deflationary risk is specifically beneficial to the financial sector. The problem with the financial sector, or at least when I talk about it with most investors, is that that's the part of the equity market where people really talk about being too far too fast. I can't possibly buy it here. It's gone up so much off the bottom, specifically banks outperforming, you know, certainly when you narrow it down into exact metrics in terms of trough to peak. And the financial sector is one of the more interesting sectors where I say statistically, it's the only sector that you actually have to chase. So where most sectors, their past performance is really no indication of their future odds of outperformance, in financials, there's a very strong corollary where outside recessions, you'll see where most sectors are around 50-50 odds. Financials on the left is 68% odds.
So as Denise just mentioned, this chart being referenced here, Financials, Three Unique Facts, can be found on her LinkedIn, along with other charts of the week collections from Denise.
And outside recessions, even when you have a prior outperformance, as steep as we've seen, over 15% of outperformance of the market, it actually goes up 85% odds. So again, unlike other sectors, financials actually is the definition of sort of animal spirits. Once they get going, they tend to stay going. And in some ways, the rationale behind that makes sense. The book value of financials is very strongly correlated to the equity market. So that outperformance tends to make them cheaper on their book value, which tends to increase the odds. I think what you have to know about financials from a risk reward perspective are that their V bottoms can be extremely powerful. Not all of them are powerful, but oddly, some of the most powerful ones are not correlated to earnings. So let's take the 2000 example where financials were sort of dominant leadership position out of that, let's call it recessionary stock market trough in 2002, 2003, when the tech wreck was really ensuing. What you'll find is that earnings were mediocre on a relative basis and on an absolute basis. And the outperformance was really driven by rapid multiple expansion. This is a similar setup for very different reasons that I think investors need to be aware of. So financials and energy are strongly correlated in the sense that I call them pain trades, because you could end up in a situation a year from now where you say, geez, looking back, they didn't really earn that much money, but the stocks outperformed a lot. And the reason is because of that multiple gap.
It's interesting because there's such a discussion right now, and partly because, as we mentioned off the top, we're seeing S&P 500, you know, hit these all-time highs and so on. And so there seems to be, within the discussion of a rotation from growth to value and so on, that many have gone so far so quickly, and and now we need to see earnings, you know, on both the value side and the growth side. The earnings seem to be coming very closely into focus, like show me the money, literally.
Yes.
But you're saying this is a little different, really.
Yes, this is definitely different than most cycles. I mean, I think that it's true in terms of at the aggregate level, you will have to see earnings at some point. But when I look historically, the gap is much longer than investors expect. Or at least maybe when you're in it, it feels like it should hit this quarter, when statistically it's really anytime over the next year to 18 months. And that's the harder part for investors, because I think that you think that they need to show you the money now. But history actually suggests that it's not really now. It's sometime soon in the future.
Now-ish.
And that creates a problem. Now-ish. Exactly. And that really creates a problem. But again, I think that the way I look at the data from these valuation levels and from the critical drivers, like the demand declines, like CapEx to sales for energy and for financials, like inflation and interest rates, I think you got to think of the risk reward in a different sort of bucket than last cycle. If the losers for last cycle were defined by that deflationary risk, that if that is sort of what we're unwinding over the next decade, they could be the beneficiaries.
That is fascinating. Okay, so here's a question that takes us a little bit back to the story of stimulus. The question is, interesting, the governments are reacting faster to a possible recession. Does it mean then that lows will probably be shorter in the future, putting greater upward pressure on stocks?
That's certainly a possibility. I would say two things. One is that all the data that I look at, whether it be the VIX, whether it be uncertainty levels, whether it be the spending of the federal government, suggests that there will be more volatility, meaning that there will be more variability in the indices. And the problem with variability is that it's quick. So I think to that end, I think it's very possible that the downdrafts are very quick, and as are the updrafts. So that this typical correction that we always throw out general metrics that last between 1 and 2 months, maybe it starts to last between 1 and 2 weeks, which is more aggressive and more volatile, especially as you sort of absorb it as a day-to-day investor. But ultimately, when you look sort of at the chart over the long term, it actually, again, leads to those very rapid lows and very rapid highs. So I think that could be exactly the way it plays out.
So much of what you've said on the employment front and the reason why it's different and stimulus is sort of the answer to that. What then when stimulus is a question? Does everything fall apart?
Yes. So stimulus always happens every recession. It's very different this recession. Like on average, I say it's 8 times greater than what we typically see in terms of spending growth than any recession back to 1960. So there's math behind that. That's also on my LinkedIn feed. So this is very different, but it's not that spending doesn't happen every cycle. I mean, it was coincident with the bottom in the market in 1974. That was October 1974. So stimulus, the goal, if you were the government, the goal, it's not always that they achieve their goal, is to start the animal spirits. You get it going, and then the animal spirits take over. The way the animal spirits take over more formally is in some ways through easy credit. Let's call it credit, lower credit risk. So you can sort of see whether or not the animal spirits are believing you in credit spreads. And that shows you default risk, right? So what did the stimulus do in terms of the potential for cash flow over the next couple of years in the equity market or for any individual company? And this was really the fundamental difference versus 2009, where credit spreads really remained elevated, where default risk remained very elevated. The stimulus did its job in the sense that it took default risk in aggregate very low. So now we're faced as equity market investors with credit spreads being at their bottom quartile level. By the way, while equity valuation spreads are still quite high on a relative basis, so there's more dislocation in the equity market. But given the economic backdrop, credit spreads are likely to get even tighter. So I think as we go forward, the sort of key to watch would be those credit spreads. But I think as stimulus rolled off, we're already getting indications that the real economy is rolling on. So to sort of boil it down, if the theme of the last decade was we never really reached escape velocity, I think you got to think about the next decade as an investor where you have increasing probabilities of reaching that escape velocity as we roll off stimulus.
That's fascinating. So actually here, a couple of questions rolling in. So you've mentioned actually EM at the beginning and where this story fits, and you've talked a little bit about it being sort of leadership for the US and perhaps other countries as well. But the question is, where does tech and EM fit into this rotation trend? I mean, EM did go flying there for a while, but where do you see that as well as tech, which is obviously the growth side?
Yeah, I'll cover them both. And they're two different conclusions for me. So EM certainly has outperformed, I would say, on the margin, given the great underperformance that we saw over the prior 18 months. I think the risk reward for EM relative to any other part of the market or any other geography is negative. And I'll tell you why. I think that EM has been historically a recovery play when it's been teed up on relative valuation being at bottom quartile levels and relative growth being at bottom quartile levels, meaning that it was cheap and recovering at the same time. It has not been in that situation to date, and I don't think we'll be in that situation on a go-forward basis. International is the same way. You don't see that sort of coiled spring that we had in the prior two recessions of washed out relative valuations. It's true that absolute valuations are cheap, but relative valuations, and I think given the stimulus in the U.S., puts the U.S. in a much better relative growth trajectory. And I think that the bigger problem with emerging markets, I'll give you two, is one, lower returns and operating margins cycle to cycle, which to me as an investor, I think about the potential for value trap. When you grow less on a relative basis or return less on a relative basis each cycle, you might be warranted to have lower relative valuation. And I think the second thing that gives me pause about emerging markets is, given that U.S. interest rates are going up, they tend to be more or less in the crosshairs at that time, which wouldn't be the only reason to sort of pull back as an investor, but that's on my watch list and warning list. I don't think it's going to be anything problematic over the next, let's call it, year, but I think that's something for investors to keep their sort of eye on. Technology, to me, is in a completely different bucket. As much as we sort of argue between growth and value, and I do think if you had only two widgets to play with, I do think value has the advantage over growth. But the S&P 500 technology sector is pretty diversified and doesn't all fit neatly into the growth bucket. In fact, some of large cap tech I would call value oriented, specifically semiconductors, which are at their bottom quartile levels on relative price to book. But even the tech sector overall, again, at the sort of two-digit GIC level, you see that median relative valuation levels on both earnings and cash flow with operating margins that are actually increasing. That's a pretty good setup historically for a sector. Don't confuse technology with high momentum non-earners. That's, you know, many high momentum non-earners are technology stocks. But not all technology stocks are high momentum non-earners. So if you're sort of looking at the two-digit GIC level and say, I'm a technology investor that wants to own a broad swath of the market, I think the risk reward there is still positive. And I see a historical parallel where the market really broadens out to not only be dominated by U.S. technology, but to include technology, energy, industrials, and equal weighted discretionary, and like we talked about, financials.
Very interesting. I don't know if you see the types of technology companies that you were just describing there almost as or becoming consumer staples. Like someone was mentioning, it's not as much fun when you buy a new phone now. You know, it used to be like, and now you're like, I just need it like I need a dishwasher or toaster or whatever it is. It's just a necessity.
It is a staple. I think that's a great way to look at it. And they have the margins that the staples companies had back in the 80s when they were growing just as fast as technology companies are.
Very interesting. Okay, another question here. I want to add this in. So what are your thoughts on gold and silver? This is with the impending increase in underlying metals. Okay. Yeah, let's go to the commodities, but obviously the precious metals.
Yes. I mean, the precious metals are sort of the most interesting because I always, and I think I've said here before, I always struggle with it because sometimes it's an inflationary play. Sometimes it's a deflationary play. Is it negative real interest rates that's the critical driver? Is it increasing real interest rates that's the critical driver for gold? When I stand back historically and say, what really improves your odds sustainably cycle to cycle? It's increases in outperformance in metals and mining. That's your biggest corollary. Don't forget that gold and copper are closely correlated, both in mining and largely in the equity market. Now, the free cash flow generation is a little bit different cycle to cycle. So I don't want to like forget that. But I think that when you think about that sustainable inflationary sort of trajectory that's different, the beneficiaries could certainly be materials companies. And gold is a strong corollary to that. So if you think about that demand being a secular change from the last cycle, I think the risk reward for gold and silver specifically is still positive.
Thank you, yes. Denise Chisholm, for joining us. We look forward to seeing you, I think, in 2 weeks from now, and have a great weekend.
You too. I will be here in 2 weeks.
Looking forward to Denise Chisholm joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.